So thanks a lot for inviting me to speak and for the stimulating discussion that we've had so far this week. So I will go through a number of the studies that were performed in the context of the FCC-PSM report that is being produced, should be on the archive any day now. We're struggling with the last few submission issues, but you can see a draft already at the Twiki page here. It was a massive effort by a lot of different people. Many of the contributors are actually in the room today, and so you'll be familiar with a lot of the results that I show here. And a lot of them actually are results that haven't changed much in the past few years, and so some of the results will be less new to you, and some of them will be a little bit more recent. And apologies to some of the authors. I didn't meticulously go through all the slides and add in specific archive references for all the subcontributions, but basically all the content that I'll discuss here is contained in the PSM report. So I'll start off with some introduction and explain my personal biases and priors for approaching this sort of topic of experimental challenges in physics reach at 100 TeV. And then I'll flash a slide on dark matter, but Matthew actually covered a lot of the dark matter material that I might have otherwise covered in my talk. So I'll skip over that and focus instead on exotics and SUSY searches and what reach we expect and what the specifically the experimental challenges I think that arise from the interesting signatures that we would like to probe. And then I'll come to some conclusion. And I'll try and keep it short so that we can keep a lot of time for discussion. So my priors, some of my priors. So when I was constructing the talk, it was a fairly generic title of new physics at future hadron colliders. But really, from my perspective, life at 33 TeV is an incremental step away from life at 14. So from an experimental standpoint, things change by a little bit, but not by an order of magnitude. And so really, I focus on 100 TeV and the challenges that arise from that large step in energy, and also the large step in luminosity. So I would claim, and I think we do claim in the report, that high PT physics will continue to be easy. And by easy, I mean not that we can do it today, but that we expect that we should be able to do it when the time comes, and that the experimental community will solve those challenges to give us still access to basically all of the electroweak, all of the Higgs, and so on. The challenges do exist, but I claim that they're tractable. And I'll highlight a few of the challenges. And certainly, I don't mean to demotivate any R&D funding. In fact, it's just the opposite. You know, we need R&D funding for detectors and accelerators to get there. And so I'll try and highlight some of the challenges that I see. But I think that they are tractable. I think that the larger challenge for us as an experimental community is keeping access to low PT, multi-object, and unconventional signatures like displaced signatures. This is going to be the major challenge, and specifically in the trigger, but also even offline at some level, especially once we approach pileup of 100, or sorry, 1,000 per event. It's going to be very challenging. This is undercovered in the literature. I think there's been more coverage in the past year or so, which has been great. It's also undercovered in this talk, but I think in the end it's going to drive a lot of experimental choices and a lot more than we give it credit for right now, except on the Higgs side where I think the challenges have been very clearly articulated. So I'll have more comments on a lot of these things in the conclusions, and I'll discuss some of the various aspects of this as we go through the slides. So dark matter, I wanted to show at least the table of contents to show the sort of comprehensive structure that we have for discussing WIMP dark matter. Putting it in context with direct detection and indirect detection, and also going beyond WIMP dark matter, especially, which I don't think Matthew discussed, but I also won't discuss here. So looking at asymmetric dark matter and Hidden Valley models. So we have quite some discussion in here about these things. I think it's mostly speculative. It's less on the sort of concrete phenomenology study that motivates specific math thresholds or what have you, but it gives you a sense of what the signatures are and what the challenges will be. So thank you to Matthew for summarizing this so nicely on Tuesday, and I'll skip the rest of the dark matter for later and move right into exotics. So, I'm going backwards in the way that we presented the material in the report. We started in the report with SUSY, then we went to exotics, and then we went to dark matter. But I want to discuss exotics first because I think actually exotics does a better job of motivating a lot of the detector challenges that we'll have. In some ways because the signatures or the processes are somewhat cleaner. And especially in terms of bosonic resonances and fermionic resonances, we have clear signatures that we want to look for. They motivate clear mass scales and PT scales for certain objects that we want to reconstruct. So I'll discuss some of these first items, new gauge bosons in dileptons and dijets, and also in TT-bar, which I'll have some discussion on the detector challenges here. And then a bit on top partners and twin Higgs, which motivates some displaced signature searches. And then we have non-resonant signatures, which I'll mention this running of the electroweak couplings. But there's a lot of other material in the report that discusses a lot of different aspects of life at 100 TeV that I encourage you to read. So first, to start off with dijets at the LHC. So dijet searches at the LHC, its first paper that came out of ATLAS was dijet resonance search. First paper at 7 TeV, I think it was the first paper at 8 TeV, probably one of the first papers at 13 TeV. It's one of the earliest things that we do. And whether you call it a Z prime, so if you look at this recent CMS result that uses data scouting, here they're setting limits in the coupling versus mass of a Z prime plane. Where you can see the 8 TeV ATLAS and CMS results over here. This is using all the unprescaled triggers for ATLAS, for instance, in blue, and then CMS has this data scouting technique that allows them to extend the reach at smaller couplings and lower masses by using data that is not kept offline. But only kept in the trigger. So this is a sort of Z prime inspired model. But then you can also consider that this Z prime or other mediator would be giving us access to some dark matter. And so if you compare the monojet and monophoton searches down in this corner, accessing relatively low dark matter masses and low mediator masses, we also have substantial sensitivity to dark matter type models, simplified models, from dijet searches at 8 TeV and now also at 13 TeV. And this will continue to extend up. These contours are, of course, dependent on these choices of couplings. But in general, our limitation at low mass and at low couplings is going to be from triggers and what we're able to keep in our detector or in our data sample. Offline, and then at high mass, we're just limited by cross sections. And so this issue of triggers, we've been encouraged, I think, so far to pretend that we won't be encumbered by, you know, triggers and having to throw away events at level one or level zero at 100 TeV. And I would claim that this is a nice, you know, way of motivating some searches, but I think it's something that you can take too far. And I think it's going to be extremely difficult or even impossible almost to imagine pulling all the data out of these larger detectors at 40 megahertz and keeping it all for offline storage. So I think we do still need to consider what we can do at lower masses and trigger level. And so if you look at now at 100 TeV, we see our 8 TeV and 13 TeV results squeezed now in the lower corner of this mass plane for the Z prime. And at 100 TeV, we're extending the reach up to many tens of TeV in these dijet resonances. So depending on the luminosity, we can reach different couplings. So the improvement at high mass is clear and in some ways intuitive, right? In many ways intuitive. On the detector side, the challenge here will be to keep the calorimeter resolution good so that we have good access to these narrow resonances. And so one nice study that was done is looking at the width over mass as a fraction here. Or as a percentage here on the y-axis, and looking at different constant terms in the calorimeter, which is really what's going to dominate the calorimeter resolution. And so you can see really the blow up in this reconstructed width, assuming a narrow width Q star at 40 TeV, right? So as the constant term gets larger, you really have this blow up and you really lose sensitivity very quickly. So this is on the high mass side. This will be the challenge here, is to construct a calorimeter where we have excellent resolution up to very, very high PTs. At low mass, unless we do full readout at 40 or even 200 megahertz, if we're considering a 5 nanosecond bunch spacing scenario, we'd have a 200 megahertz event rate. We will need some sort of trigger level analysis to improve this at low mass. And one of the take-home messages that we had from Maurizio at the Slack workshop on 100 TeV physics was that this was a significant challenge for the LHC detectors, or I should say collaborations to implement early in run one. And it's something that they're ramping up on in run two more significantly and more intensively. But it's something that we should anticipate from the very outset at high luminosity LH, FCC, and not just for this analysis, right? We should be able to have this ability to do this for other analyses as well. Yeah. Yes.
So on an event-by-event basis, this information cannot be accessible.
No, event-by-event, that's right. But you can store sort of minimal event content event-by-event in the, using trigger information. So it's not necessarily an analysis. Now, if you have a mass of interest, of course, then you can do an analysis if you want. But no, this would be analysis is a misnomer perhaps, but it's storing reduced event content, right?
So you're just reiterating the scouting knows.
Exactly.
It's not self-interest.
Well, but
it's scouting that Maurizio and others have then decided to actually publish. So you can, if you want, and you believe that you understand things well enough, take the reduced information that was used for scouting and actually do an analysis with it. It works for simple analysis like that, like it doesn't.
You can do analysis offline.
In principle, you could do it in semi-real time, but I don't know if there's any advantage to that. But if you wanted to have the scouting be automated, you would have the computer make the plot with the four vectors that's scouted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was has an implementation of this or something like that. But you know, the real idea, as you know, from the scouting was to find something and then assign more bandwidth to that trigger to get the full event. Taking the instant in the sense when you don't find anything in scouting and you still want to publish something, you can do with analysis.
Some people, Dan Weisman's been going around recently saying we can improve digest searches at low mass by looking for various sorts of ISR, like they click on. So, in the same way that we use, we'd be using IPT tapes on the TDB, do we have hope of getting access to the low mass region in a different way by looking for various sort of
So I think Daniel is moving several analyses through Atlas now that go along these lines. And so I think we should be able to extrapolate from there. I think that's right, yeah. Yeah, the radiation certainly is easier there, yeah.
So
that's
it doesn't have to be that one-to-one correspondence. It's probably a good idea.
But I'm saying now we do that.
Yeah, now.
But that's with a lower rate, right? That's with a lower rate than the scouting in principle, right? The data parking is when you're right? Now you do it at the full rate, I see. Okay. Right.
Can I ask the theorist though what kind of physics we're talking about here that we wouldn't see it? At low mass, but we wouldn't see at LHC, but we could only access some kind of portal or something that only opens up after some energy.
Naive
question. I mean, this falls into the category of we have to really make sure we have significant computing infrastructure so we can do this kind of stuff even at 100 dB. But we're already going to be challenged to reconstruct all this information from these complicated events. It's not, the computing challenges are going to be great without adding extra stuff.
Well, so if you look at this plot, you get the worst sawtooth of all these digesters, and sawtooth will be between the 100 TeV and the 14 TeV searches, right? If you go to the endpoint, you get 100 TeV, you run up until you get the 14 TeV.
Right, So it's just the.
Right, but I think here's a good point. Just look at statistics. We're talking about 500 GB object, 300 GB object. The rating is going to 100 GB is really new, because it's electric light. There is, of course, more luminosity. Let's say there is a factor of maybe 10, 20, perhaps. Okay? And if one is very efficient in using coming in and seeing the TTV kind of like engine, it's like to the gate.
Import TTV data, better analyses, and license metrics, and push that 100, and you could, I bet you could get away with that choking cell.
I mean, that's the real lesson from it, because we have some of these holes in diet searches from that the Tevatron in principle could have gotten to, but didn't. And you know, yes, it's great that we can invent and use the extra computing capacity to try to fill them in. But having been, you know, someone who worked on the Tevatron, I wonder why they couldn't have done better if they knew these guys, you know. And now we're in the same place with LHC. I think we have to push as far as we can because to add more demands on this 100 TV.
But I think, you know, once you have 100 TV, you don't have the LHC anymore to collect events, right?
That's
and not, so.
That's 4 years and, so.
Yeah. This isn't to demotivate searches at the LHC, right? At all. But,
I mean, but yeah. Your point was to keep this in mind so we may design these experiments to be able to go as low in mass. And that's a good thing to do. But the more things we add to the list, the more complicated and expensive these.
Of course, but we need to start from everything that we want, right? And then descope, as you said the other day. So.
I mean, there's also the thing, right? We can talk about 100 TV maybe the last collector we get. So in the same way, the tricky things that we do now in the LHC are motivated by, well, maybe we don't need another collider.
Right.
We definitely don't need another collider here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So. Don't remember why he cut it off at 10.
I'm just curious. I mean, like, it might not be 300-400 GeV. I mean, 2 GeV backgrounds at 100 GeV, or
no, it's definitely not. So yeah, it's definitely not just 300 or 400 GeV, right? It's I don't recall. That's a good question.
It's a very conservative analysis, I think. So.
Yeah. That's right. So less pessimistic picture for dileptons and diposons, fortunately. So if we can think about now a Z prime decaying to dileptons, the cross section will be significant in sort of most vanilla, albeit natural models. But the challenge here, experimentally, will be reconstructing muons with very high PT. And I think there's been some studies in the SEC context that have shown that their resolution for instance, 20 TeV muons doesn't need to be exquisite to understand or to discover something out here. We can get away with running for a little bit longer, collecting a little bit more data, and recovering some of our sensitivity to these high mass Z primes. But it still means that the upper end of our PT spectrum is going to need to reach to 20 TeV, 30 TeV, something in the muon spectrometer. While at the low end, our lower bound doesn't move, right? We still want to reconstruct muons with a few GeV of PT. So we're increasing the dynamic range of our muon reconstruction by a factor of 10 or so. And so you can see sort of the increase in reach for these dilepton resonances in these orange curves down here, going from LHC 8 and high luminosity LHC now to FCC at 1 or 10 inverse attobarns. And so we're reaching out to these 10 tens of TeV. I think these make some assumptions about resolutions. Ricardo, you did this, right? For a lot of even at the LHC, for a lot of these very, very high mass guys, right, you see the events creeping up before you even see any background from Drellian. And so you can almost do cut and count in some wide mass window without reconstructing a peak. So I guess that's all you did, right?
Yeah, it was
more wondering about the highest masses where the muon resolution can be
Right, and so I think this is even pessimistic in the sense that, that the resolution can be very poor, right? For the W prime now, it's getting to die bosons. So this is another active area at the LHC where we have searches for W prime to WZ or Z prime to WW or spin 2 to WW or ZZ. Here we have some results that are reaching, of course, lower cross-section times or larger cross-section times branching ratios in the limits and correspondingly lower masses. But at FCC, we'll be still reaching these 10 to 20 TeV new boson masses. And so if you do a sort of naive calculation of what this hadronically decaying W or Z would look like in our calorimeter, we expect that all of the hadronic activity would be contained in a radius of around 0.02. So this motivates a cell size of less than 0.01 in our HCal. And I'll come back to this in the next few slides. So moving on to TT bar resonances, we had some study, I think, that was done partially for SNOMAS, but then updated for FCC BSM, where we have TT bar resonances going up to 20 TeV in mass and benchmarked by these Pythia leading order Z primes or KK gluons. This was, I would say, a slightly more sophisticated study than the Z prime to dileptons or dibosons in the sense that it wasn't just a rescaling, but it was only performed at particle level in Pythia. So their claim is that they can reach up to 20 TeV, but they employ B tagging and top tagging of these events. But if you do sort of a naive calculation of how far you expect these Bs to fly, right, it's going to be roughly 10 centimeters per TeV for a B hadron. So if you're thinking about 20 TeV heavy resonances decaying into TT bar, then each of those Bs is going to have around 5 TeV, and you're going to be flying around 50 centimeters, which is a significant challenge for LHC detectors, certainly, but it's something that we would need to keep in mind for. Yes, that's right. Now, in the absence of any other number, then yeah, right. I think Andy will talk about this. So if we think also about top tagging in this context, okay, so this is a study that was performed in the context of a stop search, but it's equally relevant here. So if we think about tagging tops using some generic top tagging algorithm for relatively soft tops at 100 GeV colliders, so PT greater than 500 GeV, our top tagging efficiency is quite good, and our QCD fake rate is still quite low. Once we move to the 5 TeV regime in PT, and we look as a function of the cell width in our HCal, the ability that we have to distinguish between these subjets within this large archet. Above a cell width of around 0.02, our efficiency really takes a nosedive. And so for reference, the ATLAS cell sizes are around 0.1 by 0.1, so out here. And the CMS HCal sizes are a little bit finer. So in addition to making our calorimeter that much deeper to contain these jets, we will also need to increase by a factor of 10 the number of channels that we have in our HCal. No, but at some level, I mean, if you want to resolve substructure, you're reaching the intrinsic resolution of your detector, right? And so I think they chose this because this is sort of less scale sensitive than some of the other top taggers. But in the end, I think you're going to see something similar. It's just a matter of how far this. Yeah. So moving to top partners, where we're considering, for instance, single production of a T prime with some charge decaying, for instance, to WB. So these will have similar challenges to TT bar resonance searches, but a little bit less activity and also in some cases a VBF-like signature where you have these forward tagging jets that you can use to further reduce your background. And so we look here at the mass of these top partners versus the coupling that allows single production up here versus only pair production down here. And we have a fairly generic exclusion up to around 90 EV for these top partners. That's relatively model independent. I think they say completely model independent, but I sort of doubt that that's the case. So one of the last topics on exotics is this area of twin Higgs. Several of the authors are in the room, so I'll let you all explain this in more detail if you like. I'm only just learning about this model myself. But this twin Higgs model allows a sort of UV completion of neutral naturalness in a way that that produces a lot of very interesting signatures in our detector. And so the signatures that they considered here were these heavy partners producing tops and these twin bosons, I guess, that decay to invisible particles or semi-stable particles, these semi-stable hadrons. That have masses of in the tens of GeV range, I guess, right? 10 to 100 GeV range, something like that. And C tau in the centimeter to meter range, or in the 1 centimeter range. And so what they looked at then was assuming a background-free analysis, I think, and looking at assuming also a displaced tagging efficiency of 10%, which is taken from from recent Atlas and CMS results. And at some benchmark parameter choices, and looking at the reach in TEV of these twin partners for the heavy guy over here and the twin of the lighter quarks down here. So you have some exclusions coming from Higgs fits and so on, but the most sensitive searches end up being these TT bar plus displaced searches that give you access to this multi-TEV region. Now the question I have for you guys is looking at these C taus, I would also expect that these guys would fly quite far based on if you're talking about decays from a 10 TeV guy. So I think here it's going to be a mix of not just displaced, but also TT plus MET, things like that.
Right here. I mean, the thing here, right, is these particular things, depending on how you view twin gigs, you may or may not get these off that angle for permanent states, and that's what you're getting. Right?
Yeah.
And so there's also things, the Higgs is still also related to these things. So
okay.
There you have, you just get more of the natural artifacts.
So the last thing I want to mention that's been shown in several of these workshops in the past, and so I won't go into it in too much detail, is the running of the electrorecouplings that several people have been working on, so Josh and collaborators. So here the idea is to probe running of electrorecouplings by studying very high mass dileptons, so looking at very off-shell Zs decaying to charged leptons, or even off-shell Ws decaying to L nu. And you can see that independent, almost independent of the type of new physics, if it enters in at some mass scale that's accessible to these high mass dilepton searches, you should see an impact in the running of these couplings, a deviation in the running of the couplings from the standard model predictions. And these deviations are on the order of a percent level, so we need excellent understanding of statistical and systematic uncertainties in dilepton mass spectra. But if you can achieve that, and their results at 8 TeV show that this is actually very achievable, and scales very nicely to 100 TeV, we can have very model-independent constraints on various types of SU2 multiplets, or even just generically within the MSSM, or in a less model-dependent way on generic U1 or SU2 states out to several TeV, so just completely excluding anything running around at low masses. Yeah.
They have this plateau with low masses, right? So if you go from 3 to 30 mesodobon, which is a common benchmark, the sensitivity gets crazy good.
Ah, okay, so, I hadn't appreciated that.
Point out, right? Because you have this plateau, so you just push that down a little bit, right? And then suddenly your mass reach goes from, if you're under GeV, that's one limit, to like 2 GeV. Yeah? So going, this is a huge motivation. I mean, I don't know where this plateau comes from.
Well, I think it must be coming from just your statistics and the very high mass net, right? Okay, so moving on to Susie. So we had quite a lot of studies in the SUSE context. A lot of these are not new, and so I won't go in too much detail on some of them, but well, we did have some discussion earlier about some of the stop searches, and so I'll mention some of the cuts that we had there that motivate some of the results that we have. And we had some discussion earlier in the week about more indirect probes and model, or you know, how to interpret discoveries or you know post-discovery at 100 TeV. So I won't cover that here, but we have much more discussion in the report. So life at 100 TeV in the SUSE context, so if we're thinking about strong production, these are the cross sections that we would expect. And so down here, you're talking about, I think, 10 events in 10 inverse attobarns. And so we're reaching out to 10 TeV and up even for stop masses if we can construct a relatively background-free analysis with good efficiency. So in this report, we've been emphasizing relatively generic searches. We do have some model-specific interpretations, but mostly it's simplified models and just telling us what we have access to in terms of detector signatures. From pretty generic searches with JETS plus missing ET or dileptone, same-sign dileptons plus JETS plus missing ET for some of these more complicated signatures. And then for the stop searches, we have this muon and JET and top-tagging approach. That were shown earlier in the week, actually, but that I'll also come back to. So one of the only real detector challenge that I want to mention here is that in compressed regions where you do expect there to be some small mass gap between the objects and the cascade, we often implement separate searches to improve the sensitivity, but the detector challenges are really going to be keeping access to soft stuff, keeping access to soft leptons, soft jets, displaced if we have small couplings between these objects and so on. So in terms of Gluino reach, in the sort of vanilla jets plus missing ET analysis, these are plots that have been recycled many times, but we reach out to around 13 TeV in the exclusion and over 10 TeV for 5 sigma discovery for relatively light neutralino masses. If we consider the diagonal region, there's a lot of analysis strategies that would give us more access up here, but we will start dying off at around 5 or 6 TeV in the neutralino masses. And there's a lot more tuning that could be done for all these things, but this gives us a generic understanding of how high we can reach in mass for gluinos, pair production of gluinos. If we consider gluinos decaying via off-shell stops, so we have 4 tops plus missing ET in the final state. Here we have a slightly more complicated analysis that gives us better access to this diagonal compressed region. And this multi-signal region approach gives us fairly comprehensive coverage up to around 6 or 7 TeV in the gluino masses for 5 sigma discovery. The detector analysis challenges that I wanted to highlight here, so the L-hadronic channels are not included here, right? These are just the dileptone searches. Even within these dileptone or single lepton searches, the lepton ID in isolation is really a key thing. So whenever we're talking about leptons being produced here, it's right. It's from the decay of a W inside of these tops. These tops are being produced at basically a zero mass relative to this heavy gluino, and so these things are often very boosted. And so these leptons are often deeply embedded inside of jets. And so our usual isolation schemes for suppressing fake backgrounds at the LHC just don't work here. And in fact, all the delta simulations that we typically run impose some isolation on the leptons before they're even stored as electrons or muons. And so this limits our ability in some ways to study these non-isolated signatures in our current detector cards. And of course, we have this issue of high PT top tagging that we discussed earlier. For direct stop searches, again, we have a huge increase in the cross-section relative to 14 TeV that gives us access to much higher mass stops. And so the question is, you know, if we look at the number of searches that are used to probe this direct stop production mass plane here at the LHC, this is a very rich area of study that we have ongoing, and it's hard to imagine reproducing all of these different searches in 100 TeV context now. And certainly, I think the big challenge at 100 TeV will be to continue to gain access to some of these holes at low stop masses near the top mass, but probably at that point at higher neutralino masses. I'm guessing or hoping that the LHC will be able to fill in some of these. So the search strategy that I wanted to highlight, since it was mentioned earlier in the week, for the stop pair production is to look for these boosted tops. one of which decays leptonically, and you require a muon to be embedded within this jet. And so if you think back to early B-tagging algorithms with the Tevatron, this is basically the same thing, looking for non-isolated muons that are consistent with being embedded within some hadronically decaying object. And so in combination with some other event topology cuts, specifically this minimum delta phi requirement, we're able to suppress almost all the other backgrounds while keeping reasonable efficiency, order 10% efficiency for our signals, and killing the QCD almost entirely. So our, yeah. Yes.
On you starting perfect, but I think you shown that this is also.
Well, it depends a bit on how deep the calorimeter is, but yeah, at these high PTs, I agree, right? Yeah. So in this specific study where we're really just looking at how high on this x-axis we can go for relatively light neutralinos, we do have some compressed analysis, but really the focus was pushing the mass scale up here. We do have discovery reach up to around 60 eV. There's another study that's outlined in the report that shows a similar model, but looking at the all hadronic decays. And here they also reach up to around 6 or even 8 TeV, depending on the integrated luminosity. OK, so weak production, many aspects of weak production fall neatly into dark matter. And so thanks again to Matthew for covering dark matter so cleanly on Tuesday. The one weak production area that I wanted to discuss was just electroweak ENO production, where you have some mixture of Higgs-ENOs, MUNOs, and BINOs populating the next to lightest electroweak ENO and lightest electroweak ENO states, where these are mass degenerate and within a generation, let's say. And so their strategy is similar to the strategy that we have at LHC, is to use a combination of three lepton, same side dileptron, and opposite side dileptron analyses, and optimizing the heck out of cuts on MET and PT ratios and HT jets and effective masses and so on. They make a point of the need to relax cuts on lepton isolation. And in this case, they're speaking of the delta R between leptons rather than necessarily the delta R between leptons and jets. But these relaxed lepton isolation criteria are going to be a recurring theme for basically any electroweak decays at high PT and are already being studied in detail at even 13 TeV LHC for high mass diboson resonances, for instance. So results for weak production in the Higgs-ENO-BINO, Higgs-ENO-WINO, and WINO-Higgs-ENO models, which really just tells you the relationship between these mass terms. We're reaching multi-TeV in the NLSP masses and with even excellent coverage up to 1 TeV in the LSP masses in many of these models through some combination of these three searches. The three lepton channel always gives you great coverage, especially for these high NLSP masses. But in the compressed region, the same sine dileptron starts to improve, and we expect that more dedicated search strategies up here would bear more fruit if that turned out to be an interesting region. Weak production for WINO-BINO is treated separately, and here we consider a few different decay modes. But again, we're reaching multi-TeV masses for these NLSPs. For WINO-BINO? I don't know. Mantow is here, so he's focusing on the things. These are your plots. Oh. Matthew's asking about the WZ branching ratio in WINO-BINO.
Oh, you was 5 TeV. Oh, yeah.
So it's a
Okay, the last SUSY topic that I want to mention is long-lived. Okay, so now we're talking about long-lived charged leptons, which are motivated in some dark matter models where you can get a good relic abundance for moderate masses of these long-lived leptons. But other models can give you also these heavier multi-TeV leptons that are long-lived or even detector stable. And here, basically, these long-lived leptons look just like heavy standard model leptons, very heavy standard model leptons. And so the challenge is to distinguish them, for instance, from muons. And one of the ways of doing that is looking at the energy loss in the muon before reaching the muon spectrometer, which will depend on the relativistic beta. Similar, yeah, I guess, right? I mean, it's. It should be the same, I guess. Yeah. Right. So the signature that you use specifically is this energy loss in the calorimeter, and so for muons this should be relatively low, but for these very heavy guys it should be much larger, and so that ends up being the dominant background, and using these variables can help you suppress that. So just to summarize the SUSY case for 100 TeV, so we have we show here the 14 TeV. Limits. So assuming we see nothing at 14 TeV, how can we use SUSY to motivate 100 TeV? For run 2 and run 3, and then for a high LUMI phase. So those are hiding down here in the 1 to 3 TeV range. And then for 100 TeV discovery contours now, we're talking about probing 5 TeV and up for various integrated luminosities. And these are all just coming from rescaling of the analyses that were presented here to different luminosity thresholds. Okay, so in conclusion, I want to come back to the challenges in reach at 100 TeV slide that I showed before, just to fill in some of the gaps that I left out. So again, I would say life at 33 is an incremental step, and so I focused on 100 TeV. High PT physics will continue to be easy, and so I hope I've motivated larger, more hermetic, and higher granularity detectors that will solve most of our problems at high PT. So top tagging, boson tagging, things like that will require better calorimeters than we have now, but I don't think that they are impossible to build by any stretch. And I think advances in computing should solve a lot of the rest of the high PT physics challenges that we face. For low PT and these multi-object and unconventional signatures, we are already struggling at 14 TeV with this instantaneous luminosity to keep access to all of our soft leptons, to even every W. We can't keep every W at LHC, right? We like to keep every W, but we can't do it, or every leptonic W, but we can't do it. And so anything that's soft, anything that doesn't give us an obvious hardware trigger, I think, it's fine to say that what could we do if we didn't have to worry about that, but I think it's important to motivate the need for advanced triggers that would give us access to these signatures using LHC-like constraints, okay? And I think that gives motivation to the experimental community, and it encourages funding agencies to consider long-term R&D and detectors and triggers as a priority for future experiments. And I would say that triggering that includes tracking in its full glory, even including vertexing, is the fundamental limitation that we'll need to face. And I think that it's important to anticipate the need for that at these machines. So there's lots of potential for discovery, but just as a reminder, the R&D for what was the SSC and then became the LHC experiment started in the 1980s, right? So that's where we are right now. And the R&D needs to be going on, even at the detector level, to build these things. So thank you very much.
I'm just, there's a general question. Is there any study being done about what can we learn from all kinds of rare decays, like top decays, and because you're making so many tops?
Yes, I think Michelangelo, in fact, has been quite involved with this. Not BSM, but yeah.
Yeah, it's not fed into the BSM chapter, I guess, but It's not complete. In the standard model, there is a section on top properties. So the focus has been mostly now on the couplings, anomalous couplings over top, by looking at TT-bar Z production, for example, or TT-bar a very large mass, where you have VS gluon, VS channel gluon, so you have a gluon very much of shell, so probing both chromomagnetic and electroweak dipole moments. There has not been an update on using, for example, single top production to, and rare decays like flavor change neutral current decays, and that too has not been updated for 400 TeV. So there is plenty of work to be done there. And of course, there is a lot of room for studies of rare decays of or properties of whatever comes out of the top decays, right? Because it's 10 to the 13 tops, so that means 10 to the 13 Ws, which are tagged, because you tag the top and on one side, and on the other side, you have the top decay into W without any trigger bias. So any possible W decay, in principle, you can go and look for it, right? We studied that in some at some level for some of the kind of rare standard model decays, but not for BSM. And there are opportunities that's been pointed out a few years back by Gilad and others, again, looking at B decays from top decays. And you can do the same with charm, of course, that's from the W decay goes to charm, and then the taus, because again, there will be about 10 to the 12 taus available in these events. Well, the main advantage here is the tagging, right? Because you know exactly whether it was a B or a B bar. So you're gaining statistics because you don't have the dilution that you always have in all of the analysis at the plus and minus factories, where you don't know exactly whether the B had already. But there are no, again, the idea is out, some studies have been made, but the details have not been. In fact, when the paper came out, it was mostly in the context of the LHC, so we were not dealing with the huge statistics that we have here. There is a lot of work to be done there.
10 to 13 dots, you can actually get close to a standard model on CNCDK.
Yeah, in principle, yes, of course, yes. Yeah. But I mean, we know that. If you look at the LHC projections, for example, something like top goes to charm Z, well, even at the LHC, we have 10 to the 10 tops, 10 to the 9 tops, right? But the branching ratio is 10 to the minus 6, right, or 10 to the minus 5 or 6, and that's because if it goes to Z, then it's the Z goes to plus C minus, and then there is the background, so...
But even to be within, you know, the orders of magnitude.
Yeah, yeah. Again, there could be new opportunities because of those. Maybe you lose a bit in statistics, but the moment, again, you ask the top to be boosted, all of a sudden, a lot of the backgrounds go away. The Z, you can start using hadronic decays if it's boosted. So it's a different ball game, right? So there's a huge domain of studies to be done. And in the context of the detector discussion, and also going back to the discussion we were having yesterday, there is room for thinking about a detector, but it's really focused on relatively low-scale physics, say sub-TeV final states, that could ideally put to tape every single top produced, right? If there is, you know, the equivalent of LHCB for the B, an LHCT, an FCCT, for the top, right? That would do the top, the Higgs, of course, and everything that speed of the TeV scale. Well, it could be, you know, a super duper CMS size like object with full coverage. Yeah, and it would be focused. I mean, the data acquisition would be, of course, the main focus. You would give up on the ability to have resolution, for example, for multi-TV objects. So it wouldn't have to be very, very big. You wouldn't need to track bees decaying after 50 centimeters, for example, because once again, you're focused on the bulk of the production. And therefore, it could be, it's a bit like, you know, LHCb. LHCb can do things that the other detectors cannot just because it's more focused, right? It was smaller relative to the bigger ones. It would still be, you know, a CMS like. Oh, you certainly need more. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other interesting point. I mean, in principle, something like these could, you know, give up some factor of 10 in luminosity. Even for the context of a Higgs, there is a huge Higgs rate. Yeah, exactly. And with a factor of, yeah, absolutely. And that is something that's not been touched at all, but I hope that sooner or later people will start thinking about it.
Now let's thank Mike again.